great creedal song to confess together as Christians have for the 2,000 plus years, the great truths. Thank you, worship team, for leading us in that. And I am going to lead us this evening in a responsive reading on the church, if we could see that PowerPoint. This is a responsive reading on ecclesiology, a church for all, on ecclesiology. And after I read my part, I'll invite you to respond and read your part, okay? It's pretty simple. So, next slide. Let's practice. The church is not just a building.
Obviously.
Well done. Well done. I'm impressed. Now, where are the ordinands? They're not ordinands. Where are our new elders? Just raise your hand, you four gentlemen. Good, good, good. Okay, so this is for you, right? I don't mean to dishearten you at this point in your journey, but I did intentionally ordain you before I preached. But I will tell you, next slide, churches have problems. Now, the reason I make this observation is it seems to regularly surprise people in ministry. They get out into ministry, and then they come and talk to me about it. They're surprised that ministry is messy. Recently, I was with a young pastor in the region where we live and work in the United States. He was there with his young wife, who is a nurse, and she was asking me why things were so difficult in the church. A woman had just written her, said, "I'm no longer coming to Bible study because I'm not being fed." And the young wife was lamenting this. She asked me, "Why is it that there is less conflict where I work in the doctor's office than at church?" And I didn't know how to tell her in a way she could readily grasp. But the answer is ecclesiology, my dear. Ecclesiology. Because you have different ecclesiologies, different expectations about what's supposed to happen when you come to church, when you participate in a church, when you belong to a church. Most church tensions and conflicts are not over theology. Most of them are not over those flashpoint issues like baptism methods, music styles, not even over things like gay marriage, not over the length of the sermon, not over transubstantiation, not over politics, not over whether you can bring coffee in the sanctuary or not. Most church tensions and conflicts are over ecclesiology. We just don't use that word. They're over basic disagreements about what the church is for, about who the church is for, about who's in charge here, about how should we run this thing, about what this thing we call church should be up to. So most of the disagreements and conflicts which we experience in church, and we all have experienced them, unless this is your first day, let's see the show of hands, yeah. They come out of ecclesial misalignment, like when the front tires on the car are not aligned. You get the shake, don't you? And sometimes in church it feels like that, doesn't it? A little wobbly. Let me give you an example. For you, is the church, these are multiple choice, is the church a shelter from the storm, a holy club, or perhaps it's a hospital? Right? What's your image? What's supposed to be happening here? Maybe it's a big family for you with the occasional odd uncle or auntie. Or maybe, I would guess, some of us consider church to be kind of a neighborhood action committee to clean up the city. All of those things are ecclesial considerations. So perhaps you believe that the purpose of the church is to nurture those inside the church. While the person next to you thinks, no, that's not what the church is about. The main purpose of the church is to be, quote, missional and reach those outside. And a third person says, no, you're both wrong. The purpose of the church is to glorify God. And we get ecclesial misalignment. So there may be tension in your church. There certainly will be tension in your church, but it may be over insignificant things, really, like what color to paint the creche, or over the what name shall we put on the church, or whatever the little detail is. But it's like a family squabble where it's not really about the toothpaste, or it's not really about the little thing, you know, that you're choosing to squabble about. It's something much deeper. And those deeper things is really over, are really whether we view the church as a family or a hospital or a cathedral or a retreat center or a theater production or a holy mountain or a gymnasium. Which is it? Really, it's a wonder we have as few problems as we do, isn't it? Churches have problems, problems that flow out of different ecclesiology. Next. It's okay for churches to be different.
Brilliant.
See, in America, brilliant means very, very smart. And here I learned that it means just like, okay, it's all right. It's mediocre. Yeah. I came and I spoke here at one of the first pastor's retreats. This is years ago, and several of you came up to me afterwards and said it was brilliant, and I felt quite inflated. And then I was riding on the train, and I was talking with a gentleman, and he said I should try the ham. What do you call ham? Gammon? What is it? Ham's okay? He said you should try the ham. It's brilliant. So I travel to, I oversee 323 churches in the United States, plus a few hundred internationally. And as I travel from church to church, all within the Free Methodist network, the Free Methodist family, people will complain to me and they'll say, you know, the church down the way, even though it's Free Methodist, is nothing like ours, with the understanding being that I should go down there and fix that other church. And make them all just like their church. So people complain and they say, you know, we're all in the same denomination. Shouldn't all of our churches be the same? And I think not. I think it's brilliant for our churches, not like ham brilliant, but, you know, I think it's brilliant for our churches to be different. I think that's a good thing for there to be shades of different emphases contextualized, right, within our communities. So we do all emphasize the essentials. I mean, there are certain boundaries, and we're quite clear on what those are. And then we encourage each local church to be different according to calling and context. Really, there are many perfectly fine ways to do church. I mean, just look at the scripture, right? In a moment, I'll come back, and I'll point to what I think are some essential ingredients in a Christian ecclesiology. But please note that most of what we do in church is not mandated by the Bible. These are just our ways. These are traditions. So let me take you back to Moses for just a moment. It doesn't even appear in the time of Moses, right? They're wandering around the desert. It doesn't even appear that they had a weekly big gathering. They had the Sabbath, right? But it appears, it says, when Moses would walk to the temple, to the tent of meeting, that every family would stand and worship in the entrance to their tent. It appears it was more family gatherings, that's how they had their regular worship times. And then, of course, they had the daily sacrifices. So this Moses had this tabernacle, which was primarily a place for killing animals. Had you wandered into the tabernacle on some normal day, you would have thought you had stumbled into the slaughterhouse. I mean, this was blood and guts. This was a visual enactment of how holy God there at the back was, and how messed up out here in front we were, and there somebody had to die. And you'd bring your goat in, or your sheep, or you'd wring the heads off the birds. It was a bloody place. And that was the ecclesiology. To drive home, to help people understand, this God is not like us. We cannot just casually approach him. the ecclesiology, the purpose of church was to purify the people so his purity did not consume them. As, for instance, Korah, you remember that story. That was the ecclesiology. Move forward, fast forward to the time of the temple, right? So now, you know, I've jumped over a lot of history. But come to the time of Solomon's temple. The ecclesiology there focused around this yearly calendar of rituals. The feasts, the coming to the temple, the coming to Jerusalem three times a year. But then when Jerusalem was destroyed about 586 years before the Christ, then they no longer had the temple. And another form, another ecclesiology rose up, the synagogues, right? So now with a minimum of 10 men meeting in a house, they were able to constitute a synagogue. They read the Torah, they sang. I mean, that was church. But very different from the tabernacle where they're killing all the animals. Very different from the, you get the idea, right? There's these different phases, and they're all legitimate ecclesiologies. Jesus comes, and he attends synagogue. These small gatherings of Jewish people. We know from the several stories in the scripture where Jesus enters a synagogue, we know that they had the custom of standing up, they would take the scroll, they would read it, then there were words after that. So we know some of what went on in a synagogue. That's what church looked like for Jesus. It didn't look like this. That was valid. This is valid. Then after the day of Pentecost, the first Christians who were accustomed to synagogue just kind of morphed synagogue, and they began meeting in homes, but they met daily, not just on the Sabbath. They met daily, and of course they also met in the temple, as you remember the story. So tabernacle, temple, synagogue, homes, all valid ways of doing church. And since that time, now 2,000 some years, right, various Christian traditions have developed different ecclesiologies, different understandings of what church is about how churches should be organized. What is your ecclesiology? Interesting to think about, isn't it? And you have one. I can assure you, you have one. Here's a question which will help you understand your own personal ecclesiology. The question is, what has to happen for it to be church? If you can say, well, this has to happen, then you will understand your own ecclesiology. Now, let me show you a few examples. Could we see the next slide? These are four different Christian legitimate ecclesiologies. The first one, some traditions believe the key element of the church service is the Eucharist, the sacrament. And for those folks, if you haven't taken the Lord's Supper, you have not been to church. And you could readily name some of those traditions, right? Where you have to take the sacrament or you haven't been to church. That's a sacramental ecclesiology. Another tradition is where they think that the key element of a church service is the movement of the Spirit, usually through the fivefold ministry of the Spirit. And if the Spirit has not been manifest in a worship service, well, we're going to stay till he is. Okay, so that is a charismatic ecclesiology, because the charisma must happen or you have not been to church. You can see how this is going, right? I mean, you get the idea. It just depends. It's not that they don't believe in the other things. It's like this is just the main thing for them. Another tradition is the tradition that focuses on the Reformers' cry for, in Latin, sola scriptura. Right? Just the word. Just the Bible. So for those traditions, it's the centrality of the preaching, the centrality of the written word, and preferably in an expository style. I mean, you know, that's the way this tradition developed, and you very well may have drunk heavily in that tradition of the preaching of the word. And the rest of the service they describe as the preliminaries. You know, little things like worship, little things like offering. They describe those as the preliminaries. Now we'll get to the real thing, the preaching. Okay, well, that is a proclamation or a preaching ecclesiology. Another example would be a revivalist ecclesiology. And there the focus is on salvation, right? If there has not been an altar call, do you use that terminology? If there's not been an altar call or an invitation to step forward and enter into a saving relationship with Jesus, then you haven't been to church. That would be a revivalist ecclesiology. Because of the word revival, you see that. One other tradition would be the justice ecclesiology. This tradition focuses on activism, biblical activism. And for these folks, the key element is going out and making the world a better place. It's not so much what happens here. This is simply the place where the saints are equipped so that they can go out. And if you haven't been motivated to serve, then you have not been to church. That's a justice ecclesiology. Well, you can see how it gets to be messy, right? We all come with ecclesiologies, and then we sit down, and maybe church doesn't quite feel right. It's because we have different sets of expectations about what we're trying to do, how we should do it. So even though all these Christian traditions share common elements, things like prayer, things like singing, things like the reading of the scripture, things like the Lord's Supper, even though they all share common elements, they vary a lot. And I'm saying that's okay. This is Wesleyan. I mean, part of the genius of Wesley was that he didn't allow the movement to be narrowed, but to drink deeply from the broad traditions of the Christian faith. He held them in tension, and we do too. Because the key ingredient of church is not the what. The key ingredient is the who, and I don't mean God. The key ingredient of church is the other people who are there with us. And that's why it's messy. So, you know, the kind of easy answer is to say, well, the key ingredient of church is God, right? But God is everywhere. The key thing about church is the redeemed community gathers. So what was broken at the fall? Relationship was broken at the fall. What is restored at the cross and at the empty tomb? Relationship is restored. That's why church is hard, because we're trying to get along with each other. That's why it's harder than working in the doctor's office, because that's just a job. This is the substance of life and redeemed life. This matters. That's why it's hard. That's why it's messy. And that's why it's worth it. Because this is the church is the demonstration of the power of the cross in our lives. The question is, can we get along with each other? Isn't it lovely? It's not as easy as it looks, is it? Next slide. Because you can't have church by yourself. Precisely. See, God knew you could get along with yourself without him. But to get along with me, you need God's grace. Now, we all know people who say they love Jesus, but they can't stand the church. I mean, isn't that, at least in my country, that's very common for people to say this. And may I suggest that is absurd. It is the height of misunderstanding of what Jesus came to do. He came to restore relationship, and you cannot experience that by yourself. Now, I'm not against TV preachers. I listen to them. I learn from them. Some of them are better than we are at understanding the culture around us, and they know how to present the gospel. But I am against TV preachers if they take the place of the gathering together, because this is where we work out. Yes, we have been redeemed. Yes, we have been restored. Yes, we are different. And the evidence is, look how they love one another, in spite of how messy it is. You can't follow Jesus by yourself, as though he's your own private deity. He is the God of the whole world. And you know what we call those other people who are following Jesus? We call them the church. So get used to us. You're stuck with us. At its essence, church is about people together, people in restored relationship with each other and God. You know the Greek word for church, right? Ekklesia. You also know that Jesus didn't speak Greek, or if he did, he didn't commonly communicate in Greek. He communicated in Aramaic. So we think he would, we don't know, we don't have his words written in Aramaic. We only have the translation of his words into Greek, where it says ekklesia when he refers to the church. But we assume that in Aramaic, Jesus used the word kenista for church. Can you hear in Israel, the parliament is called the Knesset. Can you hear that root there, the kenista? That's the Knesset, which means the assembly. You know, church means the called out ones. But probably the word Jesus used meant more the assembly. How about an assembly of one person? You can't have it, can you? You know, this is the essence of what Jesus is talking about when he talks about church. It is the assembly. It is us together. A person cannot be a people. Yet church is the people of God. So the essence of church is relationship done well. What was torn apart at the fall is put back together in church. This means that church shopping and church hopping are ridiculous caricatures of what church is about. This is why church is hard, because it's about working together as a redeemed people in the middle of an unredeemed world. And guess what? Not everyone in church is even redeemed. Yeah, you suspected that, didn't you? Yeah, you probably have a list, don't you? Yeah. Well, we don't make lists, but you know, we all are moving along the path of holiness, aren't we? We all have room to grow, don't we? There are some among us who are still not at that crossing point into right relationship yet. So, of course, it's hard. In fact, we invite. This is not a club of, okay, who's everybody who has gotten to the point of right relationship? That's not church, right? It's inviting everyone. And the more life has beaten you up, the more welcome you are. Well, don't you think for a minute we might have some difficulties? We've invited in people like me, the riffraff of the world, and we've made them bishops. Don't you just think we might have some problems? And now let's talk about you. That's so funny now, is it? Yeah. Here's the most radical thing I can say. Stay. Stay when your church no longer meets your needs. Stay when the music is stuck in 1976 on a good Sunday. Stay when the coffee is bad. Stay when people behave poorly and say all manner of evil against you for his name's sake. Stay when they aren't even Christ-like at church. And they call themselves Christians. Stay when the preaching is lukewarm and predictable. Stay when the music is so loud it hurts your ears. Just stay. I'm serious. Stay. Stay when the board is obstinate and controlling. Because church is more about losing than it is about gaining. It's about sacrifice. It's about being sent as he was sent. It's about offering. It's about giving. It's not about getting. I mean, how twisted is that? It's about staying. It's about talking. It's about relationship. Just stay. Speaking of giving, next slide. Church must include offerings. So this is one of the few things that scripturally we can say is foundational for there to be church. You can trace it through all the iterations of church, and there are offerings. Because church is what you give, not what you get. Now, I know that we pastors are squeamish about talking about offering because it seems self-serving. But offerings are not about paying the pastor or paying the electricity bill. Offerings are not about those who receive the offering. Offerings are about the giving. We have examples of offering to God from the very first chapters of the book. Cain and Abel, right? I mean, the first church fight was right after they took up the offering. It's true. It's true. They brought their offerings. And then they killed each other. Well, I mean, one of them killed the other. Because Abel brought a better offering than Cain. But they see the offering from early on. Then right after the flood, what does Noah do? He brings out some of these animals he has been carefully protecting for over a year for nearly a year on the ark, and he offers them, he gives them. Much later, Abraham and God, how do they seal this pact, this covenant? There is an offering between them. And then, of course, Melchizedek, and we have the first tithe where Abram offers to Melchizedek, the king of Salem, the king of peace, the king of Jerusalem. And eventually, Abraham's faith is tested to the nth degree by offering his son, Isaac, as an offering back to God. Move on to Moses. A huge part of the sacrificial system in the desert, right, were the offerings. There were wave offerings. There were guilt offerings. There were sin offerings. There were atonement offerings. There were thanksgiving offerings. There were peace offerings. There were grain offerings. And in the New Testament, the unthinkable happens. The unimaginable happens. Jesus gives himself as the ultimate, the paramount offering. The very Son of God gives himself away. And then he says, as the Father has sent me, so send I you. So please do not shy from leading. Do not shy away from leading the church to give offering. In fact, highlight, elevate the time of offering, and people will understand church is about giving, not about receiving. We have bought into a consumer mentality, haven't we? Where church is about what's in it for me, and we need to reverse, flip on our heads. We need to do whatever the image is to get back to the reality, which is it's about what can I do here? What can I offer here? You can quote me on this. Giving is more historically and theologically central to the church than preaching. Check it out. More historically and theologically central to church than preaching is the act of giving, the act of offering. Because offering is a time of demonstrating our dependence on God, our participation with God in his mission, and our thankfulness to God. So it's dependence, participation, and thankfulness. All that is going on as we give. Now, I routinely hear churches say something which irritates me. And it's this, I'll go be in church, and the person taking up the offering will say, and I haven't heard this here, so if you said this, don't think I'm talking about you. This is said everywhere in the Christian world. If you're a visitor to our church, you don't need to put anything in the offering. And it drives me to distraction. I mean, this is central to what we're doing here. Do you say, if you're a visitor, when I get up to preach, just kind of tune that out? Offering is important. Now, I know why we do it. You know, it's because there is suspicion out there in the culture, and I get that, and if you say it, it's okay. But do you hear what I'm saying? Let's not sweep offerings under the rug as though it's the dirty business of the church. It's not. Especially in a materialistic culture, this is probably the one way people will demonstrate their dependence on God is through giving of money. Next slide. There's just one rule in church, the rule of love. Well, that's a good rule too. Let me just jump with you for a moment. I know our time is short. Let me jump with you for a moment to 1 Corinthians 14. You don't need to look it up. I'm just going to remind you, 1 Corinthians 14. We are dealing with ecclesiology in the whole book of 1 Corinthians. You know, the church in Corinth is very messed up. And Paul is writing this letter, and he's trying to straighten out the ecclesiology. And in chapter 14, he's dealing with things like minor things, like prophecy, speaking in tongues, interpretation of tongues. There was an unruly group of women who were disrupting church service, and he's talking about that. So he's dealing with all these things in chapter 14. But the section really begins in chapter 12. So you've got 12, 13, and 14, where he's dealing with how do you use spiritual gifts in church? Because it was tearing the church apart in Corinth. And what does Paul put in the middle of chapters 12 to 14? Chapter what? 13, the chapter of what? Yeah, the love chapter. Right smack in the middle of the mess of the church, Paul writes this sublime description of how we should take care of each other. See, we're so used to the love chapter, you know, being used in weddings and stuff. We think it's about this kind of love, husband, wife. It's not. That chapter is about loving the folks in your church. Yikes. Is that okay to say yikes? Okay. The love chapter is not about to be developed in the intimacy of marriage. It's about ecclesiology. Let me remind you some of what it says. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. I mean, this is for our church and our boards. This is for our Sunday school. This is for everything we do for our outreach. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. This is a description of your church. Now there are two amens. No, I know. But, you know, we're just thinking this through, aren't we? Because we're used to thinking about this as being like husband and wife love, and it's not. This is your board meeting description. So then in chapter 14, you can look at this later when you have time. In chapter 14, Paul takes the one rule. There's one rule in church, and it's the rule of love. He takes that one rule, and he overlays it then on all the messiness of the minutiae of the things that are tearing them apart. And he runs every issue through this one single, it's not a grid because it's just one square, it's just one rule. And he runs it through this simple matrix of the rule of love. And he says, this is going to solve, I don't care if your problem is speaking in tongues, if your problem is unruly, nuss in church, if it's whatever. Because he's going, they've got the whole list in Corinth, the whole list of problems. Their church is a lot more messed up than any of the churches we have. And he says, here's how you're going to fix it. One thing. You're going to love like this. and your problems will be solved. Because that's what the cross and the tomb bring, is restored relationship. There is this upward dimension to the restored relationship. And there is an external dimension as we reach out into our communities. And there's an internal dimension as we disciple our young people, our children, those who are of the household of faith. All of that, though, flows out of this transforming love. Next slide. There will be, you can't quite read that, but there will be no churches in the new creation. Have you realized you're going to have a whole nother day in every week in heaven? Because there will be no church in Sunday. So ordinands, you have been ordained today, but it's only valid until the new creation. And then you will be made redundant. No, seriously, you will. You won't have anything to do. You're going to have to find another hobby or something. We pastors will be out of a job when the new heaven and the new earth, because the church will disappear in the new creation. But you know, that's not quite right, is it? I'm not saying it quite right, am I? You know, even as I said it, it probably hit you a little funny, didn't it? It's not that the church will disappear. What is it? How could we say that better? It's that heaven will be all church. All the time. And if that doesn't sound good to you, I know as a little boy that would have sounded like hell to me. Not heaven. I have to sit here quietly all the time. So if that sounds like the other place to you, you're not doing church very well. Because when you do church well, it is a taste of heaven. It's a taste of restored relationship. It's a taste of being known and knowing, of loving and being loved as you should be loved. That's ecclesiology.